Okay. Parshas Kitetze, as I mentioned to you last week in Acting, Shal Shudas has the highest concentration of mitzvahs. Mitzvah, one after another. It's effectively the end of the Torah. Kisava was the Tovacha, Nitham Vayelah was Moshe's final discussion with Am Yisrael. Hazinu takes the bris and incorporates it into a poem, and there's also Brach. This is really the conclusion. The end of Kitetze, as you know, the final mitzvah is the mitzvah of Zechiras and Bechiras HaMolech. The final mitzvah in the Torah, historically, we're inching our way towards that, to build a kingdom of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, a world of Malchus Shakai, the elimination of Amalek, or whatever that means in our day. Fascinating issue. I don't want to talk about it today, but I will talk about it during the year, but it pays to at least mention it. Where should the Parsha of Bechiras HaMolech logically have been written? Not in Parshas Kitetze in the end of the Torah, but where should the mitzvah to destroy Amalek logically, sequentially, chronologically have been written? Parshas B'Shalach, the war was fought. The first battle was more or less an armistice, more or less, there was an even battle. The battle ceased, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu should have and probably commanded Moshe Rabbeinu to continue the destruction of Amalek. Why is this mitzvah to destroy Amalek relocated to the end of the Torah? The answer should be obvious. Could you imagine if the first mitzvah in the Torah, before Har Sinai, before Mishpatim, before Tefillin, before Talmud Torah, before Tzedakah, the first mitzvah of the Torah was to kill people and to commit genocide and to eliminate another nation. We would turn religion into a religion of death and religion of suffering and religion of Allah Akbar and religion of jihadists. So there is a place in Judaism for eliminating Amalek. I can't explain it to you. I don't know what it means. I don't know what Amalek is. And until we have a clear revelation from the Navi, no one should act upon it. But Yiddishkeit is a religion of life and of prosperity and of supporting life and of kindness and of redemption. We'll talk about this a lot this year. It's not a bigoted religion. Chosen doesn't mean chosen for privilege. Chosen means chosen for mission and chosen for higher lifestyle. And our arc is the most universal. I'll say this a lot to you this year because a lot of people your age, a lot of people, one of the real pressure points on Jews today, Orthodox Jews, is that issue. What does it mean to be chosen? Am I better than anyone? Am I bigoted? Am I a racist? What does it mean to be better? Am I becoming too nationalistic, too xenophobic, too selfish, too self-aggrandizing? Remember, the Jewish people are the only people without crosshairs on everyone else's back. You carry a big, big bullseye on your back for every Muslim. Every Muslim has in his mind, whether militant or otherwise, and in the end of time, you will become a Muslim or you will be eliminated. You have a big bullseye on your back. And every Christian has in their mind, not aggressive, it's not militant, that in the end of days, you will convert to Christianity or be eliminated. Most people don't act upon it. They're civil, they're respectful, but that's their end game. Judaism is the only religion whose end game is not converting everyone to Judaism. I have no interest to turn anyone into a Jew. That's not my goal. That's not my mission. Our mission is to broadcast and showcase monotheism, to broadcast and showcase morality to an entire world, by our experience, by our lifestyle, to show a world what Malchus Shakai is, to show a world what monotheism is, to show a world what Kadosh Baruch Hu is. And Kadosh Baruch Hu tried for thousands of years to spread it evenly, and after 2,500 years, when it utterly failed, after 2,000 years, when it utterly failed, Hashem had to select one people to have more mitzvahs, more exposure, more revelation, more responsibility, and through them, the world would see what monotheism is. And He chose us. And by the way, that experiment has worked fantastically. Just remember the world your ancestors inhabited. The world of heathens, the world of pagans, the world of barbarians, the world of virgin sacrificing idol worshippers. Today we live in a world of reason and a world of monotheism and a world of morality, and Christianity and Islam more or less are triumphs of Avraham. More or less they're pretty close to monotheism. And when Shiach comes, it's not going to have to overrule Islam. It's not going to have to change Islam. It's pretty close to monotheism. We have to make certain changes, certain adjustments. When Avraham Avinu, when Mashiach comes, he's not going to have to totally overrule Christianity. He'll just have to eliminate the pagan vestiges, the pagan residue. But by and large, we have won. We've succeeded in history. Our mission as Jews, to raise a world into moral consciousness, to raise a world into monotheistic behavior, we have succeeded. I'm doing more for world peace and world enlightenment and world redemption and world progress by settling this land as a Jew, even though the world sees me as a racist or occupier or nationalist, because for a Jew the nationalist arc is universal. By advancing my national agenda, by bringing the world closer to Mashiach, by settling this land, I'm bringing the world closer to universal welfare, and not on my terms, on their terms. Not because everyone's going to be Jewish, because everyone's going to benefit from this world of Shakai, of Malchus Shakai. That's the world we're going to think about in 3 weeks. when we daven in Rosh Hashanah, we're going to announce broadly, V'yedah kol pol ki ata pi'alto, V'yomar kol asher neshama v'yapo, Hashem Elokei Yisrael Melech, U'malchuso v'kol mashal. We're going to sing that. We're going to announce that. Every celebrity that you look up to, every athlete, every politician, every Obama, every cultural influence, every intellectual influence in your life that you look up to, will look to you and say, Spencer, you were right. Jeremy, you were right. Josh, you were right. Hashem Elokei Yisrael. They'll become Jewish, they'll recognize Malchus. And their world will be redeemed. So it's not about killing people, it's not about being better than people, it's about fulfilling your mission. HaKadosh Baruch Hu's mission to us as Jews. And that mission is not about death. So that's why the mitzvah of Bechias HaMalek is delayed until the end of the time. First, learn about the society. Anyone not signed in the sign sheet yet? Okay, first, study Mishpatim. What type of society do you go in? First, study my will. First, study Tzedakah. First, study Nezikin. First, study Mardin. First, study Korbanos. First, study Ritual. First, study Tahara. And then when you finally have the whole Torah understood, the final mitzvah is Bechias HaMalek. We'll talk about this in Beit Hashem and Vayera. Because Avraham Avinu's last challenge, very similar to our last challenge. Just when you think you know Hashem, your last challenge is to perform a mitzvah that you don't know. And you can't understand. Because until you know that you can't know HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you don't fully know HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So what's Avraham's last mitzvah? Okay. Which is something a human being can't and shouldn't understand. It's murder. What's the last mitzvah in the Torah? Genocide. And if the mitzvah a human being can't understand and shouldn't understand, can you be rendered a monster? But for some reason, if you can't understand, that's the final lesson. Until we realize we can't know Hashem, we don't really know Hashem. Because if we think we know Hashem, that's taken. Until we know we don't know, we don't know. So Kitete is this long list of mitzvahs. I want to discuss one of them. A strange one. Excuse the pun, strange bird. The mitzvah of Shiluach HaKen. And I want to discuss one aspect of Shiluach HaKen. A very interesting halacha that stems from an interesting word. Actually, two words. Source number Aleph, part one. Here's the pasuk about Shiluach HaKen. Ki yikare kan tzipor lefanecha baderech. Which word leaps out at you? To be obvious. Which word in that pasuk is yikare? What does the word yikare mean? Happens. Incidentally, you happen upon a nest. And which other word in the pasuk reinforces that incidental nature rather than premeditated, precalculated performance of Shiluach HaKen? Baderech, you're on the road, you didn't anticipate it, you're traveling, you're on a journey, you discovered something. The Gemara interprets this pretty literally. Source number two, Gemara Chulin. Ki karei kan sipor, source number two, line two, Prat L'Mezumun. The mitzvah of Shiluach HaKen is not performed on a bird which is Mizuman, a bird which you're raising, which you're feeding, a nest, a bird you have in a cage. It has to be at some level unexpected. It has to be at some level encountered, a surprise. Something you didn't plan, something you didn't foresee. Now the details of what the difference between Mizuman, something prepared, and something surprising or unexpected, they're shown in work out. This is not a halacha shir. But it's an important message. What's the important message? In general, we're big fans, we're big advocates of planning, of calculating, premeditation, seeing into the future, planning for the future, organization. In fact, as fate would have it, in Parshas Ki Tetzeh, there's a nation, I gave away the clue beforehand, who represents incidental, serendipity, just coming out of nowhere, no plan, nomadic, scavengers, roaming through the desert, no particular agenda, anarchists, so to speak, which is that nation that we dislike them in part because of lack of any object orientation. Amalek. Zachar is Hashem lecha Amalek baderech, b'tzeischa mimitzrayim, source number three. And Amalek is described, and while I'm speaking to you, I want to mention, it is mamash a mitzvah d'oraisa to read Parshas Amalek. When do we fulfill the mitzvah d'oraisa to read Parshas Amalek? Parshas Zachar. But there's really no difference more or less between Parshas Zachar and between Parshas Ki Tetzeh. We just are mekayim the mitzvah before Purim because it's appropriate to Purim. So there's every reason on Shabbos when we read Parshas Ki Tetzeh to have in mind to be yotze the mitzvah of Zechiras Amalek another time in case you didn't have proper kavana the first time, if Chas V'Shalom they made out Bed in Shul the first time, or at the very least, even if you fulfill the mitzvah on Parshas Zachar, according to Maaz V'Shalom, it's not a mitzvah that you only perform once a year. It's a mitzvah which Chazal were only metaking once a year. But if you listen in Parshas Ki Tetzeh, anyone else have to throw it out? If you listen in Parshas Ki Tetzeh and you have kavanah for the mitzvah, you're fulfilling another mitzvah. So Beit Hashem on Shabbos, actually twice. You can listen to it once in Beis Hadara, and once you repeat the Maftir, you get a chance to recite two mitzvahs derisos. Those are not simple things. So keep in mind to have kavanah. So Amalek is described as Shekar Chavaderach. We understand Paro. Paro came from a culture of designing. Hava Nischak Malach. The word Hava means he gathered his advisors. He thought about the future. He had a 5-year plan for the Jews. He wanted to slowly entice them, slowly enslave them, slowly ensnare them. By contrast, Amalek had no interest. What was their purpose? Why were they bothered? We read about Balak and Bilam conspiring in the end of Sefer Bamidbar. They had an interest. They had a common purpose. They had a common worry. Amalek just happened upon us, a shekarcha baderech. Where else do we see the lack of any plan, the lack of any order, the lack of any system as being a negative? Nebuchadnezzar, source number 4. Kadosh Baruch Hu says, if you treat me with keri, if you treat me with the concept of keri, then your greatest punishment will be not sulfuric ash, not suffering, but lack of any order in this world, lack of any predictability. This world is premised on predictability. We can't predict our future, but I can't predict the physics of this floor. The fact that it's made of concrete and steel, and it's built in a certain combination, I couldn't take the next step, because I would fear that the floor would give way, and I would sink into the abyss. I would sink into the ground. I couldn't walk, I couldn't breathe, I couldn't... All of science, all of technology, all of progress is built on being able to predict, to foresee, to assume, to... So Hashem says, you have to be able to sense the order and organization in our world, in my world. If you suffer, it's not just pointless, it's not just capricious, it's not just incidental. If you suffer, then draw conclusions. Do tshuva, it's based on your actions. Again, you can't draw conclusions on a one-to-one ratio. A lot of people make this mistake. What's the difference between seeing HaKadosh Baruch Hu's hand in the world and playing God? Sometimes there are people who play God, which is morally repugnant, and more importantly, it's theologically bankrupt. Oh, you know why those people suffered? Because of that fate. You know why those people suffered? Because of that fate. There's a hurricane now that's threatening New Orleans. It reminded me what happened about 5 or 6 years ago. What was Hurricane Katrina about 5 or 6 years ago? People were saying some very ugly things. Why was Hurricane, and not just ugly, stupid. Why did Hurricane Katrina afflict New Orleans?
Mardi Gras.
Mardi Gras. Or because George Bush supported the withdrawal from Gaza. So that's why hundreds of thousands of people are suffering. It's morally repugnant to dance on people's graves while people are suffering to lodge accusations at them. It's also theologically bankrupt. Who are you to play God? You know it's in God's mind. You know exactly why people are suffering. You can draw a one-to-one ratio between why things are happening. Who are you? Who's anyone? You know Kadosh Baruch Hu, you're Bilam, you're Yodea Das Elyon. You can predict Hashem's wrath. Just be very, very careful. Very careful. Sometimes you hear these voices, especially when tragedy strikes. I remember when I was your age, a little bit older. I was in yeshiva, and there was a terrible bus accident. A bus collided with a train, more accurately, the train rammed the bus. And like 16, 17 school kids were killed. It was a tragedy. You imagine 16 little kids. And a Rav, who's no longer in politics, primarily because of that, not from our sector, announced that the reason that these children were killed in Petach Tikva was because the movie theaters were remaining open on Shabbos. And that was the big controversy then. And people were in an uproar, and legitimately so. More morally. How do you say that to families that are suffering? How do you say that? Where's your moral sensibility? Where's your compassion? Even if you're right, you know, not everything that's right you say, there's a question of timing and appropriateness and social cues. People are suffering. You don't go all fanatic on them. You don't go all pious and pompous on people. There's a time for things. Just be careful. On the other hand, the world is totally in disarray. It's not like there's no order. When things happen, they happen for a reason. So you have to have the ability to read meaning into events at a global sense. I mean, the next couple months, all predictions say that we're going to go through very difficult, trying, challenging, meaningful periods in Eretz Yisrael. We're faced with a strategic existential threat to our people. something will probably happen, although it's hard to know whether something's actually going to happen militarily or it's just brinkmanship and negotiations and high-stakes poker. But it's likely something will happen. It's likely there's going to be some reaction. Okay, so do you have the ability to respond to this, not just politically and militarily, but also to see it prophetically, to see what's going on in the larger scheme of HaKadosh Baruch Hu? Where are we in Tanakh? Where are we more or less in the hurtling towards Gula? To see it as part of a redemptive process. It's not just incidental. So often people, especially when you're outside of Israel, the whole Israeli conflict becomes geopolitical and military, and who's doing what to whom, and who's going to fend off Hamas. And when you live here, and hopefully you live on this mountain, and you live as part of Tanakh, you have to have the ability not to ignore those perspectives, but also to see this. It's not the first time a lunatic from Persia has threatened the Jewish people. It's happened before. Hisham Dalav Seinu, Shitchol Dar Vadar, Haman lived exactly where Achmanijan lived, and before he turned around, he and his 10 sons were hanging on. Okay, so we'll pass this also. It's part of a process. You have to be able to read, to live Tanakh. Sometimes people disassociate prophecy with reality. Prophecy is the one you study in the classroom. Spirituality, Hashem's Hashgacha practice, that's it. Then I go around, the world has a real feel to it. Cars and buses and trucks and airplanes and stadiums and sports and culture and movies and everything. That's the real world. Everything else is, you know, nice ideas. Can you fuse the two? Can you live through real experience? One of the things I try to do on my Twitter feed when I have time, which is very, very rarely, is try to provide these glosses. When things happen, to show people, again, I'm not, Rav Ami tells us, Rav Nodracha, tried to make us feel Tanakh very deeply, to feel that events that were, spoke to us about 48, and he showed us Prakim in Tehillim Tanakh, that to him represented what happened in 48. And he spoke to us about 67, and showed us Prakim in Tanakh. It's not just about historical arts, it's about moral behavior. Moral behavior, moral failures are documented in Tanakh, and the recovery is also documented. So if you look at this world as aimless and pointless, and you lose the sense of cause and effect in the divine plan, you're called a keri. You're someone that imputes anarchy to the world. Things don't really happen for any purpose. It's all just fate. It's all just fortune. It's all just... And part of what you'll have to learn is it isn't. Sometimes it's inverted, but that's still cause and effect. Sometimes righteous people suffer, and there are different responses to why righteous people suffer, different reasons for theodicy, why bad things happen to good people, why good things happen to bad people. I'm sure Rabik will talk about it. I'll try to talk about it a little bit at a lower level. But at least you have to see the world as organized. Even if you don't understand the codes, you can't decode it, it's still a purpose. It's a purpose. And Hashem says, if you fail to heed that message, then you know what your punishment will be? Not that I'll punish you, because when you're being punished by a Kodesh Baruch Hu, there's still a relationship. Even when you're punished, you still feel Hashem's presence. First, Rashi and Masay. Why are those 42 locations in the desert listed? Who cares about those 42 locations in the desert? Where do we care? They're lost in history. Only archaeologists care. They have no kedusha. Does anyone know where these places are? Divla Soima and Chatzasam Tamar. Who cares? One of Rashi's answer is it's a mashal to a father and a child. The first Rashi and Masay who have to go to visit a doctor because the father and child are deathly ill. And when they return, they have fond memories of each place they were at on the way to the doctor and how scared they were and how terrified they were. They have fond memories of being terrified, fond memories of suffering, fond memories of being ill, fond memories of throwing up, fond memories of puking, fond memories of chemotherapy. At least they're together. At least the father and the son are together. Even when they're suffering, they suffer together. And the suffering bonds them together. So even when we're punished, we still feel it. We're standing in front of Hashem. Some of your deepest moments religiously is when HaKadosh Baruch Hu speaks to you in ways that are harsh and difficult, but he's still speaking to you, and vice versa. Sometimes your closest moments at HaKadosh Baruch Hu is when you speak to HaKadosh Baruch Hu harshly, but you're still with him. Even when you rebel against Hashem, you're still in a relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. You're still responding. You're rebelling against Hashem, but you're there. When HaKadosh Baruch Hu is written out of the equation, that's when you feel the emptiness. That's when you feel darkness. Hashem says, you want to build a world. You want to build a world of aimlessness, then your world will become aimless. I won't be there at all. Not to punish, not to reward. I'll just take, just walk away. I'll take the pass. Very famous Rambam. The Rambam says that kares is not a punishment. Kares is a result. So many things are not punishments, but results. For example, all the terrible midas. There is no punishment for a midah. It's a lav shein bo maisa. You know why there's no punishment for a terrible midah? Because the punishment for a terrible midah is a terrible midah. Your person is always angry. Hashem doesn't have to punish you. He sits back and watches and laughs. Because you spend your whole life being angry. What type of life is that? Full of rage, full of fury, full of irritation, full of ire. It's not a way to lead your life. person was always jealous. You can't make peace. Sometimes people are always jealous. They just can't appreciate what they were given. They're so driven. They're so hard-nosed. They're so edgy. They're always looking at the other person. You know the punishment for being jealous? Obviously, you're constantly on edge. There's no peace. There's no tranquility. There's no appreciation. There's no investment. Whatever you have, you just can't appreciate. It's a curse. Some people are cynical, sarcastic. Punishment being a cynical person, you'll be a negative person. You'll negate the good in everyone around you. I know some people are smiling, but it's natural to bright people to be cynical. Why do you think comedians are so smart? Because most of comedy, a lot of comedy is based on cynicism. It takes a smart person. There are two types of people in the world. Some people in the world are acceptors. They see people, they see institutions, they see ideas, they see experiences, they say, that's great. If on the long term, they're great. But really smart people can always find the flaw in everything. They can find the flaw even in the greatest person. They can find the flaw in the greatest system. They can find the flaw in the greatest experience. And if you're really smart, you can see it. In comedy, you take that flaw and you interpret the whole thing and make fun. Bright people have a greater explanation for sarcasm. It's documented in an article from 2 years ago in the New York Times. They actually traced sarcasm to a particular part of the brain. Okay, there's a lot of very interesting neural mapping that's going on now, neuroscience, one of the real cutting edge parts of technology. One second, they track it to a part of the brain. And that brain is larger in brighter people. People of higher intelligence, that part of their brain is larger. So it's actually neurological. It's not just behavior. Neurologically, people that are smart have a greater inclination towards sarcasm. But I didn't need the New York Times to prove it neurologically. That's study. It's obvious. You end up being a person who's sarcastic and cynical, and you negate people around you and ideas, and then you start to tighten the noose and you start to negate people closer in your circle, your friends, your family. At a certain point, you run out of people to negate, and there's only one person left to negate. Who's that? Good old you. Then you become that bitter old man and children you've all met, where nothing is good, and the whole world is a fake, and everything is cynical. Or you don't want to become that person. It's not a life to lead. So you make a choice at a certain point in life. You make a choice to go down that route and to keep up the sarcasm, and keep up the cynicism, and make fun of people, and always point out the bad. Or you just make a decision to be a positive person. And you know what bad of people. You're smart enough to see. Smart enough guy. I know the negative in this. I know I can find the negative in anything. You give me something, I'll find the flaw. Trust me. But you decide not to apply your mental energy to that. It's not your interest. You're going to be an accepting person. You're going to be a person who just celebrates the positive. It seems very cliche. It is. To highlight something the positive is really hard when the negative is so glaring. It's easier when you don't see the negative. It's harder to look at the whole package. Now, what did you want to say? Yoni?
I think so.
And brighter people and possibly more gifted in that respect. Every trait Hashem gives you, every trait HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives you has its opportunities and its challenges. And one of the, I just tell people, if I were, I know we're going really off board, I really wanted to cover a lot of this. Maybe I'll steal an extra 15 minutes this week because there's no chook today at 6:15. Oh, he's switching? Okay. Some other time. Remind me some other time to talk about the three changes I would make in the educational system of Western civilization. I just got to tell you one of them. The first thing is like ridiculous to me that our institutions celebrate how many brain cells you've been given. Like, why would you want to award people for being bright? Why would that be your award? If you were the principal of the school, shouldn't the award go to the most complete person who shows the best moral character, who shows the best commitment, who shows the most emotional... Why would I award you just because you're brighter than the next guy? So that's a trait Hashem gave you. You can use it for positive. It's not just school. Our entire culture. Supposedly, you advance professionally, you advance in your career. But unfortunately, because and every one of you is bright, well, most of you are, you've spent 12 years being told how great you are just because you score a certain mark on a test. And very often it camouflages real serious character flaws. Because you're walking around school and everyone's celebrating, everyone's telling you you're great, everyone's telling you you're the top student. And then one day you wake up and you realize, I've got some real character issues that I've got to deal with. I've got to really make, hopefully you wake up. If you don't wake up, it's even worse. You wake up later and then you're gassed. Then you're looking at the mirror test, and you're not happy with what you see. It's a terrible thing. It's harder to understand human nature and character and order, but if I were running a school, I would eliminate all awards, and certainly eliminate all intellectual merit-based awards. Why would you create that culture? It's hard enough that earning power is oftentimes, not always, but oftentimes linked to intelligence. So in the broader world, that message is going to be broadcast very powerfully. Is that the message we want to live by? Is you're a better person because you're smarter? Ridiculous. I mean, it's insulting. Why would anyone want that message to dictate our society, our community? So why can't we just build schools before you'd be exposed to those very, very polluting and corrupting messages? Why can't we build schools at least to remind you of what's important? Character, virtue, nobility, commitment, whatever they are. Build a collage, build a kaleidoscope of different character values and try to inculcate them in people. We're just getting lost by one of the advantages I sense in the Israeli educational system is more often than not, high schools don't offer the awards at all. But certainly the awards are not based on not intellectual base. They're based on character, they're based on performance, service rendered, etc. We got to get back, because now that I found our lead tag, I have a lot in store for you. So obviously, guys, I don't know how much we'll get to, but obviously, preparing, organizing, premeditating, planning, applying the system, it's all good. It's necessary. Both prospectively, what you plan to do in the future, retrospectively. I mentioned this before. You gotta build yourself as a person that can take stock. So much of life today is just this mad, wild, chaotic, ceaseless rush. The pace is so frenetic. The movement is so quick. The day is so busy that many people just lead unexamined lives, unthought lives, unscrutinized lives. If you're someone that's able to create an internal scrutiny, that from time to time you check yourself, and where am I heading, and where am I going, and to a degree, Yom Narayan is great for that. And that's the major communal scrutiny, moral inventory. But you can't just relegate it to once a year. It has to be something that from time to time, where am I heading religiously, where am I heading personally, spending enough time with my family, are my character traits improving or deteriorating? You can't just get caught in that pace. So planning is not just prospective. Planning is also digesting and processing and looking back and how my plan's working out. A lot of people plan, but there's no accountability. There's no check. There's no scrutinization. So all the plans are laid to waste. You plan, but you never connect plan to action. A lot of people have great plans, but they don't hold themselves accountable. It's the accountability. It's thinking about the plans and actually measuring expectation versus performance. I think a lot of people, and we'll talk about this a lot this year, a lot of people have issues with modern orthodoxy today. A lot of people see modern orthodoxy as weakish, as flaccid, as uninspired. And we'll talk about it is or it isn't, and what's the difference between the modern orthodox communities you come from and the community that we come from, which is really not modern. I come from modern orthodox community. I don't live in a modern orthodox community. I live in what's called the national religious community. It's very different. We'll talk about those differences. But I imagine that even the opponents of modern orthodox, again, I'm not arguing the point now, I'm just taking it as by way of reference. Even the opponents of modern orthodoxy would agree that if you took even weakish or uninspired modern orthodox Jews and lined them up and said, do you believe in Talmud Torah? Of course. Do you believe in serious tefillah? Of course. Do you believe in Aliyah? Of course I do. Do you believe in relentless chassid? Whatever you'd list off, they would of course subscribe to it and say, well, why don't you implement it more? And then excuses were again, well, it's difficult, right? This reason, that reason, this excuse, that excuse. And I'm not arguing the point now, I'm just saying that even at their worst, according to the people who feel that there's a lot to be desired, it's more or less a problem of implementation. Most Orthodox Jews subscribe to those values. No one would argue, I don't believe in Talmud Torah, imagine. No one would argue, I don't believe in serious tefillah. Well, why isn't your shul more carefully conducted? Why isn't your Torah more passionately applied? Well, this, that, the other. So it's not just a question of planning and subscribing to an agenda, but how you implement, you show passion and sacrifice. Sacrifice. People have to see sacrifice and passion. When you don't see that, you see uninspired lives, and then you feel alienated. People want to see passion, not just routine. So planning an organization is absolutely primary. But, and here's the catch. Exactly. The message of Shiruach HaKein is, there's one mitzvah, this is a paradigmatic mitzvah, that you just can't plan. And sometimes you can become incarcerated in your plans. Sometimes planning can stifle you. Sometimes planning can suffocate you. Sometimes you're so well planned out that your life ends. And everything you see is just processed based on the decisions you made beforehand, rather than fresh, dynamic exposure, encounter, thought, interaction. I'll give you an extreme, just to make you laugh, hopefully. And then I'll get closer to the gut, you know. Try to touch some raw nerves, because that's my purpose in this year. I once interviewed a boy for yeshiva a long, long time ago. It was like 17 years ago, whatever. And I borrowed him to Ben Torah today. I sat with him and said, what are your plans in life? And I meant, like, how long do you want to come to yeshiva, which college you're going to. He proceeded to tell me how long he wants to be in yeshiva, which college, what his major, graduate school, where he wants to live, who he wants to marry, he didn't have a girlfriend, how many children, what type of... And I was like shocked. I said, I just asked for your car. And they're telling us. Okay, so that's an extreme. That should be obvious. But how much dynamic growth do you really allow for yourself? So that's the dreaded C word. I talked about the dreaded F word when I spoke with you on Shabbos, and no one here is trying to make you flip out. But what we really are trying to, and this takes a lot of courage and a lot of honesty and a lot of listening, is the dreaded C word, to really change. And for some of you, that change is to learn to lend more passion to your religious affairs. Some of you, it's to reorder the valuation you put on certain religious values and how you live them. I know a lot of people look at this yeshiva, especially, you know, this is not a place that can indoctrinate me. I don't have to give up myself. I don't have to become brainwashed. I keep myself. I want you to keep yourself. But that's not incompatible. It's not incongruous with change. Change is something you should always look for. And so many times you like block yourselves in life. You impede yourself from real change because you're not willing to look at things with a fresh set of eyes. You're not willing to be inspired. You're not willing to listen. I'm just going to bleed a little bit into the next section because I want to try to cover a little bit more, but I'll come back to this. One of the early sections, going backward in the parasha, is the parasha of the Ben Sorer Umore. And we all sense that his treatment is really, really harsh. I don't know about you guys, but when I was 13 and I read Parshas Ki Tetzeh, I was good and spooked. Oh my goodness, if I make one bad step, I'm going to get it big time. I actually remember a cute little story that my mother always reminds me of. In the high school that I went to, or the grade school, I was 13, they didn't serve lunch. Every couple of days I would, you know, figure-ma-jig something from the house. So one day I went to my mother's pocketbook because she was sleeping, and I didn't want to disturb her, and I took a couple dollars. And that day my friends went out to a Fleischig restaurant, so we all had meat sandwiches, and then I opened Ki Tetzeh, and let's see, a Ben Sorer Umore, someone that steals money from his parents and eats meat. Quickly ran to a public phone because they have a cell phone. Mom, I took your money. Please forgive me. I had the specter of being a Ben Sorer Umore haunting me everywhere I went. So Ben Sorer Umore is metaphoric, according to most opinions in Chazal, it never really happened. But what's really happening to Ben Sorer Umore? Whatever the metaphor is, what makes him so criminal? I mean, so Rashi comments. It's a slight little Rashi, but it's important Rashi. Source number two, Rashi Sorer. Sorer Ben Aderech. I'm making an announcement, okay? Anyone who hasn't experienced this first part of Ben Sorer Umore should leave the room. People who wander. I don't see anyone leaving, including me. Every religious Jew wanders and explores and fails. And I told you last time, orthodoxy is not about getting it all right. Orthodoxy is about accepting it all and trying your hardest to get it all right. And so many kids in high school in particular struggle with the guilt of constantly failing at particular mitzvahs, and the guilt builds, and the frustration builds, and the anxiety builds, and I can't, and at a certain point, there's I can't live with the guilt, I'm just going to toss it. And that's not your option. You're still Orthodox. Everyone has those crucibles that just can't get past. And Orthodoxy is about accepting it all, and trying your hardest. So you fail, so get back in the ring, and wipe the dust off, and get back in, and try again, and try again. So everyone's a Ben Sorer. Everyone has that Ben Sorer to them. Different degrees. It gets very dramatic and very unredeeming when you're not just a ben sorer, but you're a ben sorer umore. What does Rashi say? A ben sorer umore. Rashi, source number Bays, part two, misarev b'divrei aviv. You don't listen. You don't listen. That's where you essentially sever yourself from any input or any change. So many people today just don't listen. Just not interested in hearing. Your own moral self-arbiters. You know, the Haredi world, Das Torah, is a very powerful axis around which the entire culture revolves. The unquestioned, unassailed, unqualified, unconditional authority of the Rabbanim, of the Gedolim, the monopoly they possess on ultimate truth, the Delphic oracles. I'm not saying whether I agree with it or not, but that's not our community. But in our community, we suffer what I fear sometimes a worser fate, the absolute absence of any authority, of any. How many modern Orthodox Jews today don't have rabbinic authority in their lives? They know better than everyone. They'll self-arbitrate. They'll self-mediate. The only thing I'll accept are my own values that I know to be right. That is the cousin. That's the genetic cousin of Ben Sarah Amar. I don't want to listen to anyone. It's absolutely crucial in life that wherever you go, whenever you become, there are rabbis and moral voices that you seriously listen to. Even against your better judgment, do you have the strength of character to listen to people against your own judgment because you know their voice to be more reasoned and more balanced? Part of marriage, and I hope you'll all have this in your marriage, and you'll realize there are certain parts of your world that your wife sees more clearly than you, and you'll learn that as you're married for longer, and you'll start to defer to her on those issues. I know there's certain parts of my experience that she just sees with greater moral clarity than I do, and I defer to her even when I feel strongly and passionately otherwise. If you don't listen, then you sever yourself from growth. And then your fate is sealed because it's just a downward spiral. It's just a precipitous fall. That's, again, metaphorically. That's why the Ben Sarah Mar is like, there's no recovery. There's no hope. You're a wanderer, so there's always hope. You stop listening. You stop input. You stop heeding people's voices. Again, metaphorically, we may as well get rid of you now. It's a metaphor. It's a story. I'm just trying to give you the message of Ben Sarah Mar, not necessarily the harsh. We'll find loopholes. Of course, we're not going to randomly kill people just because they wander. We'll find legal loopholes. But the message of Parshas Ki Teitzeh, to listen seriously. Remember a couple of weeks ago we read about Mitzvah's Milah. Now you may be shocked. We read about Mitzvah's Milah in Parshas Ekeh. That's wrong. We read about Mitzvah's Milah in Parshas Lech Lecha, in Parshas Vayera, in Parshas Tazria. But there's another mention of Mitzvah's Milah in Parshas Ekev, ironically, for those of you with sisters at home, you could share this with them, that even women are chayiv. The Targum said that women are chayiv in Milah. That's strange. Umaltem, source number four, as arlas levavchem. You have to circumcise the foreskin of your heart, in bodily terms. What does it mean to circumcise the foreskin of your heart, arlas levavchem? Arlas levavchem is a cover. And when your heart is covered, you're just not open, you're not receptive to people's voices, to tochacha, to input, to critique. Source number five, the smack. One of the Baalei HaTosfos, Rabbeinu Yitzchak of Korbil, in his Sefer Mitzvos Katan, actually listed this as a mitzvah. Mitzvah tests. Lamul arlas halev. Shenema umaltem es arlas levavchem. Perish lehoves at tochachos. Who can say in the modern world they actually like people getting in their face? You don't. You like yes men. You like people who ratify whom you are. You like people who don't push you out of your comfort zone. Who affirm who you are. That's why so many modern Orthodox people have phobia towards Haredim. Oh, they're all parking spot stealers and tax evaders. Because they do and they should push you out of your comfort zone. Why isn't your life more similar to theirs in the areas that you should emulate them? Rather than highlighting the negatives and therefore exonerating yourself from copying. Oh, well, if I could only convince myself that they're all criminals and federal villains, then I don't have to learn anything from that community. That's a cheap out. Don't give yourself a free pass. That's lame. That's cowardly. Is your Talmud Torah as passionate and committed as theirs? Don't measure it quantitatively, because they live in a world where there's only Talmud Torah, but what about the time you're not busy? Are you actually learning? Forget what about the Tanya. Do you actually learn every day? Forget it. So you're watching 5 hours of sports. Let's assume we could excuse it. But do you actually learn every day? How dare you? Not for them, for you. It's an embarrassment. That's your answer? To incriminate other people satirically, cartoonish, make cartoonish ogres out of people so that you don't have to listen to their message. Or anyone else in that, like friends. Starting to choose friends in life, those are important decisions. You're influenced by your friends. So it wouldn't be rude to your past friends, but as their trajectories change, you have to be careful about how much you invest in previous friendships and what types of new friendships you build and solicit. Because that's how you become a better person. I don't know about religion. Religion rabbis can teach you, probably. Friends reinforce. But character traits? Almost impossible. Almost impossible to change your character trait without hanging out with people who have that trait. And so much of moral improvement is changing your character. If you're a sarcastic person, by nature, you should be proud. Okay, I got your attention. What does that mean, be proud? I'm not proud of the traits Hashem gave me naturally. Whatever traits I possess naturally, I'm not proud. Hashem gave them to me. I'm super proud of the person I've become that I wasn't. I know there's certain traits that at a certain point in my life I realized I didn't possess, and I worked really hard to try to absorb them, try to train them. The only way that I knew is to find people who represented those traits and cling to them and learn from them and have an osmosis and then rub off on me. So a person who has an arla salachis isn't listening to tochachos. Interesting, because the pasuk in Akiv that I mentioned talks about two conditions. One is you don't listen. What's the second part of the pasuk? Source number four, Maltem is arlas levavchem. If you have an arlas aleid, your heart is covered, you don't like listening. The arpachem lasakshuo, you have a stiff neck. What's the difference between a covered heart and a stiff neck? I would think that a covered heart is someone who doesn't listen. A stiff neck is someone that listens but doesn't change. Because even when you listen, change is really scary. There's a lot of honesty to listen, but a lot of courage to change. Those are really the two traits of moral improvement. You want to be someone who makes changes, you have to work really hard at honesty and really hard at courage. Some people are honest, they know, they listen, they don't have their hearts covered, but just, they can't make a change. They can't walk across the bridge. It's too scary. They're too comfortable in their past. It's a security blanket because it's known. The future is unknown. Part of what I hope we're doing in yeshiva is giving you that security about your future. A lot of religious change is scary. Do I have to give myself up? Do I have to become a crazy lunatic, a fanatic, a monk on a hill? And wait a second, you come to yeshiva like this, all of a sudden you see rabbis that are pretty normal. See rabbis that are pretty handsome. You see rabbis that are pretty cool, pretty normal. I can do that. I can be passionate about religion. I can be committed. You see Kabbalah people, you see a community of people that are really, really dead serious about religion. Just normal people. So you really don't have to give up yourself. You really don't have to obliterate or abdicate who you are. It's just about keeping that personality and just really deepening and augmenting and intensifying it. Those are the two traits of change. Some people don't listen. They don't want to be honest with themselves. They have excuses. The Benarla Saleh. Some people listen, but they're just stiff-necked. They just keep doing what they're doing. If I just keep doing what I'm doing, it'll be all right. Don't muddle the waters. Don't stir the waters. Don't stir the pot. I'll just keep doing it. That's what the mitzvah of Shiluach HaKen, the combined parts, Aleph and Beis, represents. Some things in life can't be planned. Sometimes you have to be open to new exposures and new inspirations and let yourself be inspired. Some people just don't want to let themselves. I came into this building when I was your age without any plans to live here, without any plans to enter the world of chinuch, quite frankly, without any plans to stay past my first year. Truth is, I was so miserable my first couple of weeks, and it was a different time. I really begged my father to come home for Rosh Hashanah and never come back. Things started to change and I started to respond. I remember meeting a guy at lunch, like the second week in yeshiva, sitting down, introducing myself. Hi, my name is. What's your name? Tell me his name. I said, I'm Shana Aleph. What are you? He said, Shana Gimel. I remember looking at this guy as if he was from Mars. Why would anyone in their right mind would spend, what, crazy? Like, what, should be institutionalized. Are you sick? No place to go, we have to stay, and eat a free meal. Little did I know that one day I'd be Shana Chavtes. Great, what happened? But there was something calling me. And I really listened, It didn't happen instantly. At a certain point, I changed my life's arc. I didn't change who I was. I'm still the same person I was in high school. I could speak to people who knew me then. I see the same me. Or my values, my investments, where I live, my profession, my... That me was open to change. And if everything that I experienced in yeshiva then had just been reprocessed into my set of expectations and premeditations, I wouldn't be here. And you know what? You guys have it triply hard because yeshiva is nowhere near as revolutionary as it once was. When I was here, and I want to tell you all these stories, and I'm sure you've heard a thousand times. No cell phones. I spoke to my parents once. Oh, you spoke to your parents once? I spoke to my parents a half a time. Oh, you spoke to your parents a half a time? I used two tin cans with a string across the other. You have kids? We have to shout. Come on, I heard the story earlier, you know. Oh, you at the shaft. Come on. You know what it was like, but it's true. You're wired, you're connected, you'll be visited 13 times by aunts and uncles. You go out to dinner 45 times. So at least when something stirs you, at the very least, don't premeditate resistance to change. If that's your agenda this year, to be defensive. If that's your agenda, then make sure the rabbis don't get to us. I can joke with you, the night I spoke with you, okay? You have my back, I'll have your back. Okay? Sign on a contract, and when I start to go crazy, you'll pull me out. You'll wake me up, you'll splash up, please, you two friends in high school, you made the deal. When I start going nuts, please make sure. I hate to say it, but you may as well leave now. I mean, you're welcome to stay. But the year is over. Really, I don't mean to be harsh about it, but it really is. So we have friends in the Tiv Aryeh. So I used to be a teacher for Athena in the old Yeshiva Nakotov. So he has a way of being very dramatic. So he would get up and announce in the beginning of the year, he would say, I don't want to use his voice, but I could. We're very clever, just said out of affection. He would say, you know when your year ends? When you get off the plane. Because that's when the program begins. That's when the schedule is handed out. That's when you start falling into that high schoolish mode. What do I have to do? When do I have to do it? Rebbe, are we obligated for dates? We have to know dates on the test. And that's when the program starts to conquer you. And the program isn't your sign of success. It really isn't. Sign of success is, are you really becoming a different person because of everything you're exposed to? Or also just the year of knowledge and experience and a cultural gap, and you walk on and continue, and it comes and it goes out. But there are some litmuses that you can use for yourself. Are you trying to learn, not necessarily the first week for some of you, but are you trying to learn beyond the schedule? It shows that you're taking to learning. You see a larger score. It's not just about checking it off. But I do what's expected of me, but is it real? Because it should be obvious to you that if you learn based on when the schedule demands it, in 5 years you won't learn. Some of you in a year you won't learn. How many people in your life, how many adults do you know in your world that actually learn Torah? I'm not asking for a shot. But each of you count up how many adults you know that actively learn Torah. And the answer is the schedule doesn't accommodate it. So there are people that learn Torah, people that beat the schedule. Like get up early in the morning or stay up late at night or carve out time. So if you learn what the schedule allows, pretty much you will never learn a bit of Torah the rest of your life. It should be obvious to you. You have to train yourselves to defy your schedule. Davening is an extremely important litmus. Because davening by definition means you're tired. Don't sound too tired to daven, right? That's an inner contradiction. You are always too tired to daven Shacharis. You are never awake. If you are, you should have a moral check. If you're getting too much sleep, maybe you're wasting your time. You are always, by definition, Shacharis is meant to be the davening when you're asleep, okay? It's all right to sleep during Shacharis. I don't mean to sleep in your room during Shacharis, but to be sleeping when you're davening Shacharis. That's what Shacharis is. Avram is sleepy also when he davening. So that's why there's one mitzvah in the Torah that can't be planned out. Problem is, can't be planned out. Don't think that everything in life is plans. And this is difficult. How do you know when to be open to change? And you know, if I were giving you a Moshe Shmuz next year or 2 years in college, I'd say, don't change. You know, listen to all the values here in Yeshiva, and don't change them. Lock them in. How do you know when to be open to change and not? So we'll talk about that a little bit. But I hope that at the very least you sense that this is a wellspring of values that you want to draw from. There are people here that can literally make significant redemptive changes in your life. I hope you sense they are natural and positive. I hope at the very, very least there's an identification. If you don't identify here, that's the first step, to identify. Then after you identify, I'd say there are three steps. First step is identify. Do you feel an echo here? Do you feel a resonance here? You feel a stirring of your soul. There are people here that are like me, that are from my community, that know my parents, that went to school with my parents, that are here, that are living religion very, very deeply. I don't think there are any values that we'll speak of that you haven't heard before. We're not all of a sudden switching the values. Okay, these were your values until now. Now all of a sudden there's a new value you haven't thought of. That won't happen. It may happen in other yeshivas where there's a reorientation or retracting. We're not retracting you. Now the question is, okay, now lead these values real, deep, passionate, and sacrifice, and commitment. Now actually implement values. So first you have to identify. Second, you have to listen. Some people identify, but create a wall of dissonance. Identify, but, you know, it's not for me. It doesn't get through. Denial. Some people identify, some people listen, but they can't pull the trigger. And a lot of people, I feel bad to be honest, I see a lot of people that just can't pull the trigger on real change, whatever that is. It really hurts me because I feel like they're depriving themselves of something great. I once had a student in yeshiva. Whenever I see the father literally cries and hugs me out of sadness. Boy, that had a lot of issues. Bright point. Part of his issues was he's too bright for his own good. He came to yeshiva, did wonderfully, and we removed a lot of those layers. And he's really in the groove learning. Really, really in the groove learning. At February time came the time for him to decide about a second year. I'm not talking about Shana Bad, as you know, there's something we'll talk about later in the year, and all important, push you into any positions that. Just by way of reference. And he really, really needed to stay. In part because he really needed more time in the Beis Medrash. In part because his college choice then was extremely toxic. He was going to Harvard. And 10 years ago in Harvard, the situation was abhorrent. Abhorrent. 9 out of 10 people who entered Harvard 10 years ago came out not from. From the greatest yeshivas. It wasn't a good yeshiva. I spoke to our contemporaries in Kambiyat. It was just, interestingly enough, I found out the only yeshiva whose guys did well in Harvard, okay, the yeshiva with the greatest success rate was, what's that yeshiva? Rachel. I'm like shocked. So I did some study, and people told me, you know, Gush and Kambiyat, and Shalom, you know, to a degree. Synthesize, the whole world is full of opportunity, filter, good selection. Creation, evidently, was being told the outside world is terrible, there's nothing redeeming, it's only Torah, you have to tolerate your time in Harvard, so you build a wall. Anyway, that's beside the point. I was pleading with his father, so you don't understand, I have no interest, we'll fill the seat, I promise you we'll fill the seat, I have no, I'll get a commission. Not like we need the boy to come. We're not trying to raise money from you. It's totally lishma. Totally. It's not one shred. Father pulled the plug. Couldn't pull the trigger, so he pulled the plug. And today, I mean, I'm still trying. I never give up on anyone. I shouldn't say that. One type of person I give up on. Someone marries a non-Jew. I don't have the constitution not to give up. I just can't. I don't have it in me. And I feel like it's such a betrayal of Judaism. Everyone wanders, and I'm still running after this person. I'm still trying. And you got to pull the trigger sometimes. So you're going to have these moments during the year, and you're going to have to be the author of it, but I just want you to have the roadmap. Identify with what we're presenting you. Listen, when Rebbe say things, we have really, really no agenda. It's not a yeshiva that we're trying to do something or passionate, only for your own good, as best as we can see it. And then when you reach that point where you listen, and all of a sudden you're facing this, whatever they are. They can be decisions about your future, they can be decisions about your immediate future, about davening or minyan, whatever they are. Have the courage to just be a different person. Don't ever. That, you know what? If you lock that in, you'll be a better person in life, not just in religion. You'll be creative, you'll be dynamic, you'll discover new horizons. You'll be looking for new change, you'll be looking for new challenges, you're not going to let yourself be complacent or tranquil. So a lot of things to think about. The first year, I'll try as Shirim evolved to be a little less ambling and rambling, a little more textual based, but it's the first year too. I want to give you guys a little bit of orientation, some of the things to think about during the week. Okay, stop here, enjoy the week.
You can keep the sheets. You can keep the sheets.
Jerry.
Thank you.
שלום לכם מוריי ורבותיי. אנחנו בעזרת השם בימי שני, החל משש ורבע עד שבע ורבע, נלמד ספר מלכים. וספר מלכים הוא ספר גדול מבחינת נפחו, לא כל כך מוכר, יש בו בלבול גדול, במיוחד לאחר פילוג המלוכה, לאחר ימי שלמה. והיעד הוא, חוץ מללמוד את הפרטים ולהכיר אותם, כולל את המקבילות, ובעיקר לדברי הימים, ויש מקבילות נוספות בנביאים אחרונים, ועוד ידובר בכך. הרי הכוונה היא באמת לעשות תכירות ולסדר את הדברים. ספר מאוד בסיסי, מאוד חשוב, כי כל הנביאים האחרונים גם הם נכנסים לתוך התשתית הזאת של ספר מלכים. כמה מילות הקדמה לפני שאנחנו ניכנס לספר עצמו. האמת שיותר מאשר כמה מילים, כפי שתכף תראו, אנחנו צריכים לעשות גם טיול מקדים בספר דברי הימים א', אבל תכף נדבר על כך. חופן, ספר מלכים הוא הספר המתאר את המלוכה בישראל מימי שלמה, או ליתר דיוק משלהי מלכות דוד ועד חורבן בית ראשון. קצת הוא זורק בסוף איזה כמה פסוקים על המלך יהויכין שגלה, ועוד ידובר בכך. בעצם אנחנו עסוקים בספר שמתאר פרק זמן של כ-400 שנה. אמנם מחלקים אותו למלכים א' ומלכים ב', מבחינת המסורה היהודית זהו ספר אחד. החלוקה הזאת מקורה כנראה בתרגום השבעים, ואנחנו משתמשים בה אם כי היא חסרת היגיון לחלוטין, אין בה שום היגיון פנימי, שהרי אנחנו יודעים שהספר עובר באמצע מלכותו של החזיה בין אחאב מלך ישראל, ממש באמצע המלוכה, ממש בנקודה שהיא חסרת היגיון לחלוטין. כך שאנחנו מתייחסים לספר כרצף אחד. כמובן שנזכיר בציון מקומות, מלכים א' פרק זה, מלכים ב' פרק זה, אבל זה משהו טכני, זה לא משהו מהותי שרקחת אותו יותר מדי ברמה רעיונית, עקרונית. המלוכה מתחילה בעצם בספר שמואל. המעבר מתקופת השופטים לתקופת המלוכה מתחוללת במהלך ספר שמואל. אלי ושמואל הם שני השופטים האחרונים. שמואל הוא הנביא שמושך את שני המלכים הראשונים, את שאול ולאחר מכן את דוד. מלכותו של שאול מתוארת בחצי, מת בעצם במחצי, בחלקו שלושת רבעי ממלך שמואל א' מתארת מלכותו של שאול עד נפילתו בגלבוע. מלכותו של דוד מתוארת בספר שמואל ב', וסופה של המלוכה הזאת מתוארת בתחילתו של ספר מלכים. אין ספק, לפחות חלקו הראשון של ספר מלכים נעוץ עמוק עמוק באירועי ספר שמואל, ועוד נערוך להם איזו תזכורת בסיסית המתחייבת כדי שנכיר את הדמויות הפועלות בשני הפרקים הראשונים של ספר מלכים א', אבל עוד מעט נגיע לכך. לפני שאני צולל בנושא של הספר עצמו, משהו על מלוכה ומלכות בכלל. קראנו בפרשת השבוע לפני יומיים על מערכות השלטון שיש לקיים בארץ, שיש להקים בארץ, ומערכות השלטון הללו הן כוללות גם את המלך. אמנם הפסקה פותחת בכי תבואו לארץ, ואמר תשים עליי מלך ככל הגויים כאשר סביבותיי, שום תשים עליך המלך אשר יבחר השם אלוהיך בו וכו'. נושא של המלוכה הוא נושא, או בכלל של שלטון לבני אדם, הוא נושא בעייתי. ואני קצת רוצה לדבר עכשיו, זה יהיה הנושא הראשון שלנו, בלימוד ספר מלכים. כן, הספר הוא מלכים, אבל אנחנו נתחיל עכשיו לדבר קצת על דמותו של המלך היהודי הרצוי. ואני בכוונה מדבר על הרצוי, כי עוד נבדוק, עוד מעט נדבר על המדדים השונים לעניין, אבל נראה שלא כל המלכים פעלו לפי הדגם הזה, ופה בעצם יהיה לנו איזשהו מדד למדוד באמצעותו את תפקודם של המלכים השונים. נכון הוא שכבר הפעילו את המערכת הזו בספר שמואל, גם ביחס למלכותו של שאול, במידה רבה ביחס למלכותו של דוד. חלק מן הדברים הללו נוכל גם לדבר עליהם במהלך ספר מלכים. אבל לאורך ספר מלכים יש לנו גם מלכים שונים, שאני צריך למדוד אותם באמצעות המערכת הזו שאני רוצה קצת לסרטט אותה ולהסביר אותה. אז ככה, דמותו של המלך או דמותו של מנהיג בכלל, ופה אנחנו מתחילים עם בעיה שקוראים לה לתת סמכויות לבני אדם. ואין זה משנה כרגע אם הסמכויות הן של הורים על הילדים בבית, מורה בכיתה, מפקד בצבא, מנהל מחלקה או מפעל או כל מקום עבודה. סמכויות שניתנות בידי אדם, ניתנות לו על ידי הגוף שבמסגרתו הוא פועל, על מנת לרומם ולקדם את הגוף שהוא נמצא ופועל בו. למשל, מורה מקבל סמכויות ביחס לתלמידים בכיתה, כדי לקדם את לימודם, כדי לקדם את הלמידה, את החינוך וכל מה שקרוב בכך. מפקד מקבל סמכויות ביחס לחיילים שלו בצבא, כדי להפוך אותם לחיילים טובים יותר, לאמן אותם וכו' וכו'. וכך גם בכל מיני דברים אחרים. החשש הגדול שמצוי בנתינת סמכויות לבני אדם, שהם עלולים להשתמש בסמכויות הללו בדרך שאיננה ראויה, שלא לשמה הם קיבלו את הסמכויות הללו. והדבר הזה פשוט נובע מכל מיני יצרים וחשבונות פרטיים, במקום לשקול את טובת המערכת וטובת הגורם שהעניק להם את הסמכויות שלטובתו הם צריכים לפעול, אז הוא עושה שיקולים פרטיים שלו, ופה בעצם השיקולים, במקום לקדם את המערכת ולדאוג למערכת שנתנה לו את הסמכויות, הוא דואג לצרכים הפרטיים שלו, ופה יש ניגוד אינטרסים שעלול להביא אותו לשחיתות ולעשייה שלילית ביותר. עכשיו, ברור לגמרי שככל שהתפקיד והסמכות שניתנת לאדם גדולה יותר, הסכנה גדולה יותר. אדם שיושב על קופה של 100 שקלים, אם על בה זה מעשה חמור, אבל הוא גנב 100 שקלים. הוא יושב על קופה של 5 מיליון שקל, שהוא מועל בה, הוא מועל ב5 מיליון שקל. זאת אומרת, ככל שהעוצמה שלך והסמכות שלך גדולים יותר, הרי הסכנות שעורבות מכישלון של מי שמחזיק בסמכויות הללו, גדולות יותר. אין ספק שמלך הוא האיש בעל הסמכויות הנרחבות ביותר שיש בממלכה. אין עוד מישהו שיש לו עוד סמכויות כל כך נרחבות להחליט על גורל המדינה, על גורל האנשים במדינה, על חלוקת המשאבים, על גיוס אנשים, גיוס כספים. רבותיי, לשלטון המרכזי יש כוח גדול. ופה הסכנה העורבת לפתחו לפי התובנות שהסברנו קודם, הסכנות הן גדולות יותר, הן מסוכנות יותר, ולכן התורה...